From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with writer David Aaron. Unlike the protagonist of his thriller State Scarlet, Aaron never threatened to detonate a stolen nuclear warhead. But as arms negotiator during the Carter administration, he was the nuclear age's ultimate insider. Also today, I talk with filmmaker and writer John Waters. The King of Bad Taste has a new film, Hairspray, a satire of teen dance shows. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews The Current Set, the second album from bassist and composer Mark Halaias. And television critic David Bianculli previews The Man Who Shot John Lennon, a Frontline documentary on Mark David Chapman. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. After years as an arms control negotiator, my guest David Aaron created Nuclear Mayhem in his novel State Scarlet. The premise of the novel is this: a demoted U.S. Army deputy lieutenant wants revenge. He helps a terrorist steal a nuclear weapon from the American stockpile. They threaten to detonate it unless the United States removes all its weapons from Europe within 72 hours. America goes into State Scarlet, the level of nuclear alert when a nuclear attack upon the United States or one of its allies is imminent. Aaron's novel, State Scarlet, has just been published in paperback. David Aaron brings to his novel a knowledge of the real behind-the-scenes operations in the world of nuclear arms. He was involved in negotiating most of the major arms control efforts of the 1970s. He was part of the U.S. delegation to the first strategic arms limitation talks, SALT I. He was at the National Security Council under Henry Kissinger, where he worked on SALT II and developed nuclear strategy. In 1977, President Carter appointed him deputy assistant to the President for National Security Affairs. And at the close of the Carter administration, David Aaron was given the National Defense Award, the Pentagon's highest civilian honor. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Well, thank you for having me.
Here's what I can't help but wonder. When you're an arms negotiator, I'm sure you really want to keep everybody very calm about nuclear safety. Then you leave the world of politics and nuclear arms, and you write this really scary thriller about how someone can steal a nuclear weapon and threaten nuclear calamity.
Well, I decided to use fiction instead of writing a book on nuclear command and control or some dry subject like that. People have said, well, why fiction? And the answer is it's easier to tell the truth. I mean, because what I'm really interested in the book is what happens to real people when they're confronted by a crisis, a real nuclear crisis. And that's what I think that the book is all about.
But what about the idea, though, of you suggesting that calamity is just a step away?
Well, a lot of people think that the nuclear balance is extremely stable. I think it's, in fact, stable, but it's brittle. In other words, a shock in the right spot might well cause the whole house of cards to come down. And that's the kind of a circumstance I try to explore in State Scarlet.
Your novel opens with this demoted lieutenant calling. I forget if it's the Pentagon or the White House, but he calls and says, I've got a stolen warhead and I'm going to detonate it unless. Of course, nobody believes him. They all assume just another crank call.
That's right. The first question in your mind would be, could this possibly? No, this can't be true. And then the president, of course, he wants to know, how do you know it's not true? And that's where the story really begins to unwind, because the only way to find out is to do an inventory. And we have 25,000 nuclear weapons. And the whole idea of trying to do an inventory of 25,000 anything in 24 hours is a horrendous spectacle, particularly if they're nuclear weapons, if they're spread all over the world, if they're under various custodial arrangements and all the rest.
I want to get back to that idea in a second, but first the idea of a crank caller. When you were working on arms negotiations, were there a lot of similar crank calls, people saying that they'd stolen a nuclear weapon? Is this a typical crank call?
It happens, but typically the calls don't go to the White House. They go to local military bases, and a lot of them are, you know, obvious from their nature that there's nothing to them. Somebody calls and says, "Hi, I'm from Mars, and I've just stolen one of your nuclear weapons." So it is not a common occurrence, and of course it's something that if it did come into the White House or the Pentagon, people would try to take it seriously, but down deep there'd be a notion that this can't be happening.
Well, as you were saying before, when the president decides in your novel to check out this threatening phone call, they realize that it's impossible to verify if one out of thousands and thousands of weapons has disappeared or not. And I think that's one of the points of your novel, that verification and
our
inventorying own verification. Is just about impossible.
Well, I'll give you an example. You know, we had to tell the Soviets how many INF missiles we had before we signed the treaty. They had to tell us how many they had. And so we signed the treaty. And then we discovered we had some more. Somebody sort of forgotten. They were down in a shed someplace in the south. And I mean, if the INF missiles can be mislaid, you begin to, it just kind of shakes your confidence. I think that the key thing, though, is that as the head of the Macy's once told me, if you try to have an inventory of 25,000 objects, you're never going to come up with every one of them. It's not that the things may not be there. It's just that you can't really keep track of your tracks.
Well, this is a much more frightening idea in the nuclear stockpile than it is at Macy's. You've described verification as the least understood, most politically exploited notion in the nuclear arms race. Do you think that verification is really impossible, that neither we nor the Soviets could really verify what the other has because the numbers are so high and because they're so hard to keep track of?
Well, I think it's easier to keep track of delivery systems, you know, the missiles, the bombers, the submarines. Those aren't, you know, infinitely large numbers, and you can keep track of them. The nuclear warheads themselves, that's another matter. Those, we do have 25,000 on either side, as I suggested. That's why all arms control agreements up till now, with the exception of the test ban, have really focused on the delivery systems. You know, you're only allowed so many missiles, so many intermediate range missiles, so many bombers and so forth, because those you can count more easily.
You've suggested that in the past, when in treaties with the Soviets, we always pressed for verification, that we were using it just as a stalling measure or just to get them to back out of an agreement.
Well, I think sometimes we have. There have been people who have opposed arms control and have raised verification and the lack of on-site inspection as a way to kind of not have an agreement. The fact of the matter is that for most purposes, on-site inspection is not very helpful. If you're trying to find a missile in the Soviet Union, it's much better, you know, that's not supposed to be there. It's much better to have a satellite sitting out in space that can look at all of the Soviet Union at one glance and try to identify it that way than to have some guy wandering around in a Hertz rent-a-car, you know, in a camera trying to find a missile. So what it does do and what it can do is it can monitor certain specific activities and make sure that they aren't something other than they should be. And that's what we're going to have under the INF treaty. We're going to have guys camped out in the Soviet Union around a missile factory. And it can clear up ambiguous situations. You see something, you don't know if it's a violation or not, so then you're allowed to go and see the thing and make up your mind. Those are two kinds of on-site inspection that the president has managed to get for his new INF treaty. I think it's terrific. I think it's a remarkable breakthrough that he's achieved it. And I think it's going to be a real step forward in our political relationship because it will help create a greater climate of trust.
My guest is David Aaron, and during the 1970s, he was an arms negotiator, and he worked on most of the major arms treaties. And now he's a novelist. He writes full-time. His new novel, State Scarlet, was a bestseller in hardcover and has just been published in paperback. Let's talk about the INF Treaty, the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty. What was your role in the 70s in intermediate nuclear weapons?
Well, after the Carter administration had a fiasco with a neutron bomb decision, the Chancellor of Germany, Helmut Schmidt, made a speech in London, and he said something had to be done about the fact that the Soviets were deploying a new generation of intermediate-range missiles, the SS-20. And we put our heads together, and we came to the conclusion that we had to do two things. One, we had to develop a program to deploy our own intermediate-range systems, and we also had to challenge the Soviets to come to the bargaining table to negotiate their limitation or possible elimination. But because we had this problem of our credibility, and the Europeans themselves were very leery about making any nuclear decisions, it was a very difficult decision, and my job was to go to Europe, and I went back and forth, shuttling back and forth for about a year, trying to stitch together an agreement that we would go ahead and deploy, but we would also negotiate seriously.
So we built our intermediate missiles in response to the Soviets?
That's correct.
So you're saying that we really didn't need these in the first place. They were just a response, so you're happy to be rid of them.
I think quite certainly. In fact, my own personal view at the time was that we probably didn't really need them even in response to the SS-20s. We had so many long-range strategic forces. You know, we have submarines, strategic submarines assigned to SACUR that also are a counter to these things. But, you know, people can have different points of view on that. What's, I think, really important is that we've proven that we can both deploy something and, if we can reach agreement, we can tear it down. This is the first time in history that both sides are tearing down new things. Not old stuff, but brand new stuff that they just put money into.
Part of your function has been to serve as a nuclear strategist. Fred Kaplan wrote a book. He's a Boston Globe reporter on nuclear weapons and defense issues. And he wrote a book called The Wizards of Armageddon about the people who create nuclear policy. And he raised the question that it may be that nuclear strategy is a contradiction in terms, that it could be that they are just objects of sheer mayhem and our thoughts that we can build strategies and this and that, or that we're just fooling ourselves. And I wonder what you think about that.
Well, I think there's a lot of merit to it in the following sense. There are too many armchair strategists who, have never had to rid their house even of rodents, who sit back coldly calculating megadeaths and talk about escalation boundaries. They've never really been in a serious crisis. They've never seen what it's like to be in a White House where you're gripped by fear and anxiety and where people's personalities start to come apart and where the information is terribly bad. You don't really know what's going on, and where when you give an order, you have no idea what actually happens out in the field when you do it. I think that kind of a circumstance creates a much healthier skepticism about the cold, dry, analytical notion that somehow nuclear weapons can be used as pawns in some superpower game. One of the things I try to suggest in State Scarlet is the fact that it's extremely dangerous to use nuclear weapons as a way of signaling your intentions to the other side, because you have no idea once you make that alert decision what really happens in alert. And secondly, you have no idea how the other side sees it, let alone how they're going to interpret it.
Again, back in the 70s, when you were an arms negotiator and working on nuclear strategy, I think you were there during a certain shift in nuclear strategy, the shift from mad, mutually assured deterrence to a kind of first strike possibility. And the idea of mutually assured deterrence is that we've got so many missiles and they've got so many missiles that we can't afford either of us to use them because we would just annihilate the other in response. So that's what the policy had been. You worked on something called the NSDM 242. What was the premise of that?
Well, the premise of it was this. What would happen if you got in a circumstance where, for whatever reason, nuclear weapons had been used and a war had started? Not a big war, a small war, but maybe an important war, like a war in Europe. Should your only alternative be to launch all of your nuclear weapons? Or should you have some choices at that stage to maybe do something less than that? When we first came into office, when I was in the National Security Council, this is during the Kissinger period, when the Kissinger first came into office, he discovered that we couldn't have an attack on the Soviet Union without attacking China, a major nuclear attack. And he thought, this is crazy. I mean, I don't have any choices here. So the notion was to give some flexibility to decision makers if, God forbid, deterrence started breaking down. That was really the thrust of NSDM 242. In the Carter administration, partly because people like to get their own name on their own strategy, so each administration has to have its own strategy, we reformulated that as a PD-59. It wasn't substantially different from 242. But unfortunately, the notion of some flexibility, if God forbid deterrence fails, has evolved now to the notion that you should plan to be able to fight a nuclear war in order to deter a nuclear war. So you're right. A change has taken place. I'm not sure how deliberate that was on the part of the decision makers who agreed to 242 and PD-59. If you asked Jimmy Carter, when he signed PD-59, did he think he was going from an idea that you deterred nuclear war simply because you had the power and it was catastrophic to an idea that you had to actually be able to fight a nuclear war and, quote, prevail, unquote? I don't think he would have thought that's what he was signing at all.
Did you fear, too, when you worked on that document, that you were opening up the doors for more weapons, that more pinpoint, accurate weapons would be needed in case you were doing, in case you were not going out for an all-out nuclear war, but just targeting a few sites, you know, in response to someone else, to another country having detonated a weapon, or in response to what had been a conventional war?
Well, I think that that's basically one of the things that happened. Prior to 242, you had the situation where there was kind of a deal McNamara had struck with the services. He said, you let me build the nuclear weapons, and I'll let you target them. And 242 erased that distinction, and it did it for a very good reason. And the reason was that in order to do the things that the military wanted to do with weapons that weren't accurate and so forth, you had to have so many more of them. And so it was a way of trying to limit the quantity of weapons, even as the quality or characteristics of them might be modernized. But I think that the real driving force was to try to get into a circumstance where if you were faced with the worst catastrophe that you would face, you didn't have to suddenly end up in a spasm war that could destroy the planet.
I'd really like to know how you feel about the results of your efforts on that document, because you're painting a picture of wanting to have something that would prevent an all-out nuclear war, but of having the document misinterpreted and becoming an excuse almost for planning out, quote, limited nuclear war, which a lot of people think is totally unwinnable.
I think it's a big mistake, and mm-hmm. I think that we need to have now another very serious look at that. It's quite interesting to me that this new commission that has just reported to President Reagan moves away from that in some ways, but further in others, so that you really do have two very different schools of thought. They're not reconcilable. And I happen to think that those who believe you can fight a nuclear war, limit it in some way, you ought to plan to do it, it ought to be an instrument of policy, the Soviets ought to know that's how you think, is a big mistake.
Well, let me say that the reporter who I had mentioned before from the Boston Globe describes you in his book as having sat on this document for a long time, you know, playing around with the wording and pondering it, to hold it up because you were afraid of the misinterpretation that it would have, the bad effects that it would have. Is that true? And if so, how do you do it? How do you hold up a document like that?
Well, if you're on the NSC staff, you've seen what Ollie North could do by just doing things on his own. It's even easier to not do things on your own. Well, we had a lot of questions, and so what we basically did was keep asking questions. How do you know? How can you tell? What is the, you know? And the critical question is this whole issue of, can you really control these weapons? And the answer to that is, you cannot. Once the president has declared state scarlet, or the equivalent, which is now called cock pistol, once the military has these in their hands, they're going to use them in the way that they see fit from their narrow perspective of their battlefield or their mission. And it's not going to fit into some great architecture of escalation boundaries and the rest. If you've ever been in a crisis, you know the first thing you've got to realize is that you don't know anything. And the second is that when you give orders to people, you have no idea how they're going to carry them out.
My guest is David Aaron, and during the 1970s, he was an arms negotiator and worked for President Carter for National Security Affairs. He's a novelist now, and his novel is titled State Scarlet. It's a nuclear thriller. We're going to talk more after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
David Aaron is my guest. Well, you just told us that the term State Scarlet, which is one of the nuclear alert terms, is now changed to cocked pistol. Who comes up with these terms? Do you know who invents them?
Well, in the case of State Scarlet, it was some British military officer in NATO who thought it up as part of their counter-surprise alert system. And then in the case of cock pistol, I've always believed there must be – they take – you know, they look at people's psychological profiles in the military, and they find somebody who's a repressed novelist, and they set him aside in the team and say, come up with these notions, cock pistol, rolling thunder, et cetera.
Let's talk a little bit about the language of nuclear weapons and of planning nuclear war. As a strategist, you had to deal with this language. It's a very obtuse, euphemistic kind of language. You know, like the MX, one of the missiles is called the Peacekeeper. The MX is called the Damage Limitation Weapon. There's a lot of people have come up with all kinds of psychological, sexual reasons for this kind of language. Why do you think the language is so sanitized?
Well, I think it's because it's very hard to think about what they really do. I mean, you really can't sit every day with an emotional understanding and deep awareness of the fact that you're talking about things that can destroy millions of people in a blink of an eye and, in fact, destroy the planet. I mean, really destroy it. When I read Jonathan Schell's book, his first book, I, of course, knew all of those things. I knew all the radiated effects and all that kind of stuff. But by just simply going through it in very simple language and very step-by-step, he really made me relive the horror of all of that. And, you know, you can't feel that way every day and try to make decisions. I mean, even, you know, even good decisions, and sometimes there are good decisions about what to do about nuclear weapons. You couldn't live with yourself every day. And so I think that the euphemisms are designed to protect you emotionally from the horror of what you're dealing with.
When you were an arms negotiator, would you avoid documentaries and feature films that try to make graphic the horrors of nuclear war?
No, although when I was at NATO, there was a British filmmaker who did one of the first documentaries on what it would be like to have a nuclear war. And it was extremely controversial. The British BBC banned it.
Which movie is this? Do you remember the title?
I can't remember the name of it. I'm sorry. It may come to me. But it was it talked about a nuclear attack on Britain and what it would be like. And the BBC refused to show it because it was supposedly too terrible. I saw a regular screening of it. It was shown in theaters. And I came away and thought, this isn't even a tenth as bad as it really would be. I mean, in fact, all he really showed was how there'd be a lot of social breakdown and, you know, civilization would start coming apart at the seams. And that was very horrifying. He did it very dramatically. But I think that one of the real problems at the top levels is that there's a disconnect between the war planners who deal with these anesthetized terms, these euphemisms, and many of whom don't really, I think, don't even really have an emotional appreciation of what they're dealing with. And they make up plans, they make up options, they design weapon systems and strategies, and then they expect presidents and political leaders to carry them out. I think presidents, by and large, do have a sense of this august responsibility. And, of course, one of the ways presidents have dealt with this, this conflict, is that they've ignored it. You know, Jimmy Carter is, I believe, the only president who has ever practiced his nuclear responsibilities. The White House says that they give out some ambiguous signals about whether Reagan has ever done it. But it's clear that none of his predecessors had, not Johnson or Kennedy or any of these people. And it is really quite illuminating to pick up the red phone as if there was a real crisis and discover that there are 20 people on the line, none of whom you know, or maybe one or two, whose voices you can't recognize. And even if you did recognize their voices, you have no idea whether these people give good advice, bad advice, are hysterics, tend to underplay things. You know, you just don't know what you're dealing with. And when Jimmy Carter practiced his nuclear command and control responsibilities, believe me, he had a very different picture of what a nuclear war might be like, a much different picture than his strategists who sit in the Pentagon and, you know, design these plans.
Have you changed since you've left government? I know you're still consulting to some of the Democratic candidates, but you're not working with arms control in the same kind of day-to-day intense level that
no,
you were. You're not
no.
as inside as you were right now. Has that opened up certain emotions that you had to kind of repress while you were working with it on a day-to-day basis?
Well, you know, I can now speak my mind.
I guess that's one thing, yeah.
And that's a refreshing thing. You kind of have to learn to do that after years in the government. There's a tendency, you know, to sort of not only conform your language to the bureaucratic language, but it also starts conforming your mind to it. I don't think my feelings about it are any different. I don't think my judgments are substantially different. But I feel freer to express myself in a way that I hope conveys the depth of the importance of the subject and not, you know, in some dry bureaucratic sort of way.
Speaking of bureaucrats, you really seem to really enjoy making fun of certain bureaucratic tendencies, both in pieces that you've written and in your book. I want to describe, there's one character named Lagerman in your novel, who's the assistant to the president, assistant for national security affairs, and you describe him as the archetype of the proliferating Washington breed. Experts who aren't scholars, they're not exactly journalists, they're not lobbyists, but they're self-made fragments. The self-made figments of each. They're known for their pithy congressional testimony, for their snappy sound bites on TV. Did you ever feel like that kind of person yourself?
Well, absolutely. I mean, that's one of the reasons I could write about it, is that, you know, I say, well, what do you really do in life? Well, I'm sort of a foreign policy expert. What is that exactly? And it is a proliferating breed. And I think that in some ways it's not a bad thing. It's good to have continuity in Washington and have people who are in and out. And I think it's very important for these people to be out for a while. You know, they get kind of replugged into reality. On the other hand, those who've been always out and come in with some very dangerous illusions that are almost as bad as the blinders that the bureaucrats have on them.
Well, you seem to, when you were in Washington, take a certain pleasure, for instance, at summit time, seeing who were the guest experts that all the media were going to go to. And you even wrote that the real struggle during the last summit wasn't between Reagan and Gorbachev, but it was between the experts struggling for airtime. And you got a share of that.
That's right.
Yourself.
It's the has-beens versus the wannabes. It's the.
Well, now that you're living in San Francisco, do you feel like you're in exile from being in the eye of the storm?
Well, I thought I would, but as it turns out, you know, with the University of California there and Stanford University and the Hoover Institution and the Arms Control Center there at Stanford, there are as many Russians and diplomats and arms control people going through the Bay Area almost as there are in Washington, actually more than in New York. So I am still involved. I'm involved in both of those areas. And it's a way of keeping up on the technical side, which is very important if you want to know what the reality is about.
We only have a few seconds left, but I know that you had been working on a screenplay with Paul Newman. Did he approach you to write this?
Yes. He came up with an idea. We wanted to find a way to, in a courtroom, tackle some of the issues that we've been talking about here. Could you control a nuclear war? Does it make sense to have a Star Wars program and that sort of thing? So I came up with a little dramatic story about a young scientist who has a crisis of conscience and who tries to do something about it and who ends up being put on, not trial, but he is in a sanity hearing.
Do you think it'll get made?
Oh, in Hollywood, who knows?
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thanks for being here. And my guest has been David Aaron. He's a former arms negotiator, former deputy assistant to President Carter for National Security Affairs. He participated in the SALT I talks and worked on SALT II while at the National Security Council. He's a writer now and has written a nuclear thriller that's out in paperback. It's called State Scarlet. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with the editor of Harper's Magazine, Lewis Lapham. He's just written a new book titled Money and Class in America, Notes and Observations on Our Civil Religion. I hope you can join us.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, I talk with filmmaker John Waters. It's the first of a two-part interview with the master of bad taste. His new film, Hairspray, is a satire about the teased hair and the TV teen dance shows of the early 1960s. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews The Current Set, the second album by bassist and composer Mark Elias. And television critic David Bianculli previews The Man Who Shot John Lennon, a Frontline documentary that explores the motivation of Mark David Chapman. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Mara Liasson in Washington. About 200,000 Iowans tonight begin the process of narrowing the field of presidential contenders. Republican Senate Leader Robert Dole and Democratic Representative Richard Gephardt are favored to take the most delegates at the Iowa caucuses. But tough opposition from their rivals could lead to some surprises tonight. The weather may also be a factor, with light snow and sub-freezing temperatures challenging each campaign's ability to turn out the vote. Leaflets issued in the West Bank are calling for more demonstrations and general strikes by Palestinians tomorrow. It's the beginning of the third month of violence and demonstrations in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. NPR's Jim Letterman reports.
Israeli spokesman and Israeli radio called today a relatively quiet day. Four Palestinians were wounded in Gaza. A Palestinian died in the West Bank in still unexplained circumstances. Two Israeli policemen were wounded in the West Bank by stone throwers. An Israeli car was set alight near Jerusalem. Two Israeli children were stoned as they walked along Jerusalem's old city walls. More than 240,000 Palestinians in 12 cities, refugee camps, and villages in the occupied territories are under curfew. About a quarter of a million West Bank pupils did not attend school because the schools have been shut to prevent further disturbances. There was almost a total general commercial strike in both the West Bank and in Gaza. New leaflets were slipped out of the doorways of shops in East Jerusalem, demanding that the commercial strike continue for another 3 weeks. Israeli soldiers broke up demonstrations in at least four places on the West Bank and at least four in Gaza. By comparison with recent weeks, it was a quiet day in the Israeli-occupied territories. In Jerusalem, I'm Jim Letterman.
Soviet troops could be out of Afghanistan by next March. Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev made that announcement today. The withdrawal will begin in May, once final points of a peace plan are settled. The governments of Afghanistan and Pakistan have been meeting in Geneva, trying to work out a settlement. The next round of peace talks, which are being mediated by the United Nations, is scheduled to begin later this month. Arizona Secretary of State Rose Mofford is now acting governor. The State House of Representatives voted on Friday to impeach Republican Governor Evan Mecham. Mofford, a Democrat, held her first news conference today after meeting with four former Arizona governors. Laura Carlson of member station KJZZ reports.
Arizona's political leaders are nearly unanimous in their support for Mofford. She has spent 47 years in state government and is well-liked and respected by both Republicans and Democrats. Mofford says the former governor suggested that she take an active role in running the state, and Mofford says she will heed their advice.
May I say that I'd like to be a healing governor, forceful governor, and one that will act.
Mofford is to serve as chief executive pending the outcome of an impeachment trial in the state Senate. If Governor Meacham is convicted, Mofford will serve out the remainder of his term. Meacham has been accused of concealing a substantial campaign loan, misusing public funds, and blocking a state investigation of a death threat. He also faces a criminal trial and a recall election. For National Public Radio, I'm Laura Carlson in Phoenix.
President Reagan today urged private business to begin drug testing programs. In a speech to an anti-drug seminar at Duke University, the president called it a mistake to see drug abuse as a victimless crime.
The drug user is a victim. His employer is a victim. His fellow employees are victims. And the family that depends on his wages are victims.
The president praised companies that have taken steps to seek out drug abusers, saying the users themselves are often grateful. The president has said he doesn't want to put drug users in jail, but wants them to get help so they can stop taking drugs. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell more than 14 points, dropping below the 1900 level to close at 1895.72. Declines led advances 2-1. This is NPR News in Washington. I'm Mara Liasson.
This is Fresh Air. For most of his career, bass player Mark Elias has played behind other jazz musicians, like saxophonist Dewey Redman and Anthony Braxton. Nowadays, Elias is taking a more prominent role. He's part of a trio called Bass Drum Bone and an art funk band, the Slickaphonics. Elias also leads his own groups. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review of the latest Elias recording.
Bassist Mark Elias began turning up on record 10 years ago as part of a circle of Connecticut-based musicians who included pianist Anthony Davis and trombonist Ray Anderson. But while everyone he knew was putting out record after record, Elias' debut as leader didn't arrive till the end of 1986. It was worth the wait. Now his second album is out, The Current Set, on Enja, a quintet date with trumpeter Herb Robertson, trombonist Robin Eubanks, altoist Tim Byrne, and drummer Victor Lewis, sometimes joined by soprano saxophonist Greg Osby. As composer or player, Elias is well-equipped to make the transition from labor to management. He plays bass with technical assurance and plenty of muscle, cueing changes in tempo or accent with his instrument. In essence, he conducts the band from the rear. As a writer, Elias is eclectic, drawing on influences both likely and unlikely. Not surprisingly, his composing may echo his old boss Anthony Braxton's wittily asymmetrical structures. But Elias has softened Braxton's sharp angles and warmed up his cooler sound. Here's a sample of No Passport, which Elias wrote with his Connecticut colleague, drummer Jerry Hemingway. Thank you.
Mark Helias acknowledges salsa, calypso, and Brazilian music on a sprightly tune with guest percussionist Nana Vasconcelos. Nothing too strange about that. But the current set's title track recalls the contrapuntal delicacy of 1950s West Coast jazz, a style rarely celebrated back east. Current set has its flaws. The improvising by Helias's bandmates isn't always up to the level of his writing. That's probably because this particular group, which includes some longtime collaborators, exists only in the studio. Helias could have played it safe with simpler charts, but after waiting so long to step out on his own, he seems determined to stretch. Better he should reach for too much than for too little.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. He reviewed the current set, it's the latest album from Mark Helias, on the Angel label. This is Fresh Air. That's the theme from Hairspray, a new film by John Waters. Hairspray is an homage to the teased hair and the TV dance shows of the early 60s. John Waters is best known for his underground classic Pink Flamingos, a film about two families competing for the title The Filthiest People Alive. Waters had the characters do explicit, disgusting things as they vied for the title. While Waters himself has earned the title The King of Bad Taste, he's no longer going for that kind of shock value. In his new film, he continues to use some of his regular cast of odd characters, such as Divine and Mink Stoll. But Hairspray also fulfills his dream of working with Pia Zadora and Sonny Bono. The film doesn't open until February 26th, but Waters is currently making the rounds of comedy clubs, billing himself as a human trailer for the film. When I spoke to John Waters, I asked him if the corny Collins dance program in the new film was supposed to be a takeoff of the Buddy Dean show. That's the dance show that he grew up watching in Baltimore.
I watched all the teen dance shows, and so it's all of them sort of put together and pushed one step a little further. But it's not that exaggerated, basically. The kids really did look like that then. The hairdos, all that was part of it. It wasn't a rebel look. Your mother had that hairdo, too.
Well, I think a lot of us learned what it would be like to be a teenager by watching the dance shows. Did you watch the dance shows a lot?
Sure, you learned how to be a teenager from it. I mean, and there were so many gimmick dances that you had to, they only lasted about a week in popularity. There were so many of them. So you had to watch these shows. It was like homework for the weekend because everybody do those dances. And if you didn't know how to do them that weekend, you didn't have time because there was already a new one out.
You have every record and more that I can remember, the novelty records. You have the Continental, the Fly,
the Bug, the Roach, the Shake a Tail Feather, the Madison, and they're all real dances.
Well, I figured, first of all, why did you include so many of the novelty dances in the movie?
Well, because I love them, and I wanted to bring them back. I wanted the fact that that was sort of a forgotten period when every dance was a gimmick dance. So I had all those records. They were my favorite records. I used to get them out late at night and after a few drinks and put them on.
And dance.
Sometimes even dance. So I picked those songs first and sort of wrote the movie around them, that I wanted to include them.
Did you have to work hard to find a choreographer who knew these dances and could actually teach them to the teenagers that you cast in the movie?
They auditioned 80s dances because we couldn't expect them to, okay, come in and do the New Continental. How would they possibly know it? And we got the ones that could dance the best. And then when we had the first rehearsal for 60s dances, it was so frightening because they couldn't do any of them. They had to relearn how to dance because it's a completely different way. So how it worked was, there was a woman, Linda Snyder, who was one of the queens of the Buddy Dean Show, and I knew her. And she came and taught the kids the basic steps of the dance. Then Ed Love, the choreographer, who was grew up in Philadelphia, came and made them better and really choreographed them. So that's how it became. And Ed, I made a tape. Linda just did a tape of just doing the generic steps of each one of the dances, and then he built on that.
The main character in your movie, the main teenager,
right,
is a girl who's very fat.
Yeah.
And I thought it was perfect for one of your movies, that you should make, like, the heroine a really heavy girl.
Sure, because, I mean, she's the ultimate underdog, and all my films are about underdogs. She wins, she gets the guy, she gets on the show, she has a happy ending. She's great. You know, I auditioned probably every fat actress teenager in America. I saw lots and lots of them. And a casting woman in New York found her for me. And it was depressing because some of the girls would come in and I'd have to say, you're not fat enough. And one started crying because she had spent 2 years to lose weight because every director said she was too heavy.
Everybody in your movies, as you say, is usually really, they're outcasts and they're frequently somewhere between odd and bizarre looking.
Yeah.
What was your look when you were a teenager?
I went through different looks. At one period, I was preppy because that's how I grew up. But then I had bleached hair on the front. And I used to wear, then I wanted to be a beatnik. It was hard to be a beatnik in suburban Baltimore. But I wanted to be one, and I read all the books about them and everything, and read Life magazine about beatniks, and I just really wanted to be one. That's why I have the whole scene with the whole beatnik scene in the movie.
Well, there's a great scene where Tracy and her boyfriend go into, they're looking for a place to hide out, basically.
Right.
They knock on a door. Everybody's turning them away, but these two beatniks in the door that they knock on let them in, and the beatniks are Rick Ocasek and Pia Zadora.
Right.
And it's this great, like, beatnik scene in their pad, and it's a wonderful, the scene is a wonderful confrontation between the bouffant hairdo ethic and the beatnik long black straight hair ethic.
The ironed hair. Which is not an exaggeration. Around 62 in Baltimore, all the girls had those big hairdos. And then suddenly, a few of the really hip ones started doing their hair straight, and people panicked. And it was called Going Joe, meaning Joe College. And people would say, I don't know, should I be Joe? I can't decide. I don't know what to do. It was a major thing. And what happened then is the kids that did do the ironed hair eventually became hippies. And the ones with the teased hair got married and became probably very middle class.
You look like a hair hopper to me. I mean, your hair is really uncool.
How do you get your hair so straight and so flat?
With an iron, man. I play my bongos, listen to Odetta, and then I iron my hair, dig?
I think we better get going now. The coast looks clear.
Let's do some reefer. We'll get high and I'll iron the chick's hair.
Reefer?
Drugs?
Loco weed. When I'm high, I am Odetta.
In the movie, you call women with really large hairdos hair hoppers.
Yeah.
Is that a Baltimore expression?
That's a Baltimore expression.
Yeah. It's a great expression.
Yeah. Men can
before.
Be hair hoppers, too.
A male hair hopper
is, greased back and the continental look, it was called, with sport coats with a belt in the back and pointy toe shoes and that look. A hair hopper basically is someone that grew up without a lot of money, suddenly gets some, spends it wrongly, thinks they have style and don't.
Did you use real hairspray in the movie? In the opening scene, everybody's like spraying their
hair. It's real
hairspray.
Yeah, we used roughly 60 cases of hairspray in the movie, and because there's 1,100 extras. And when you worked on this movie, you had to go. It was like going into the fashion army. The boys had to go in one trailer, get their hair cut, then go to the next thing and get their hair slicked back. The girls had to go in, get it teased. We had, like, Chris Mason, who did all the hairdo, but then we had backups, people that would tease it, then she'd come in and style it. You had to go through an assembly line. So a lot of the kids that were in it finally got so sick of combing it out that they would just leave it in, and they would just go out in Baltimore with those ridiculous hairdos and just figure, too bad. You know, I can't go through this hairdo torture another day. Let's just leave it in.
Your movie set in 1962.
Yeah.
This is currently a period when there's actually a lot of nostalgia for 1962?
No, there's a lot of nostalgia for the 60s, but 62 is almost the 50s. There were no hippies. There were no drugs. Kennedy hadn't even been shot. It was right before everything changed.
That's what you chose that year?
Yeah. And so when people talk about the 60s, they talk about girls dancing in cages with fringe and or hippies or the student rebellion or all that. This was way before any of that.
Do you hate nostalgia?
Well, obviously, I had nostalgia about this movie. This is a memory movie. I'm sick of 60s nostalgia. I've been to clubs in New York where it's just like the Fillmore East, and I thought, I hated that then. Do I have to go through it another time? Oh, please, no. Not tie-dye again.
One of the big storylines in Hairspray is about the integration of this dance show.
Right.
And because it's a white-only show, except they have Negro Day once a month.
Which they did. That's not an exaggeration.
In the show you watched in Baltimore?
Yes. And they had them on other shows, too. And basically, I felt that to ignore that fact would have been really inauthentic. I don't know, is that the correct word? But if Hollywood had made this movie, they would have had blacks on the show and just ignored the fact that none of the shows, Bandstand didn't have blacks on it either. None of them did then. And basically the problem was that all the music was black, all the dancing came from blacks, black singers were on the show all the time as entertainers, but they couldn't dance. And it wasn't because the kids didn't want it, their parents didn't want it.
One of the things I really loved in the movie is that the worst insult that one girl can say about another is, she's a whore.
Well, when I went to high school, they always used to say this, that girl's a whore.
Except it was, that girl's a hooah.
Yeah, right. And, you know, the girls that they said that about never were.
Oh, of course. I mean, how many girls in my high school were really whores?
I know. I mean, they were charging money. There weren't too many of that. But they never even slept with anybody. But if you got the reputation as a whore, it lasted. And they always used to say that, whisper, oh, that girl, she's a whore. You know, it was always, at least when I went to junior high, that was a very big insult.
Did you always want to know, like, what the real story was behind that?
I always hung around with the ones that they thought were the whores, actually.
Tomorrow I'll continue my conversation with John Waters. We'll talk more about the making of his new film, Hairspray.
Everybody's jumping, moving around. Nobody's standing still, keeping the ground. You can't tell what will happen when they pass it around. And it's a bug.
This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Let's check in with host Renee Montaigne and see what's coming up. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
Wait, let me guess. A lot of coverage of politics.
You got it. Tonight, the Iowa caucuses. And we ask our political correspondent, Linda Wertheimer, to explain the Iowa caucus to us, what's the first thing you do when you walk in the door of your local caucus, and what's the second, and what's the third? It's a primer, really, on how this democracy at its most basic, that's what Linda calls it, works. And a report also from California from political correspondent Cokie Roberts. Politicians there say that because their population is so much more diverse than Iowa's, that the national ticket might look very different if the California primary was held earlier in the year, so they would have more influence.
Thanks, Renee. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. In December of 1980, Mark David Chapman shot and killed John Lennon and became one of the century's most notorious assassins. This week, the Frontline series on public television explores Chapman's mind and motives. Television critic David Bianculli has this review.
Falling, yes, I am falling, and she keeps calling me back again.
Just about everybody could name that tune, everybody over 30 at least. It's the Beatles' I've Just Seen a Face, with Paul McCartney on vocals. But the singer on this version is a lot less familiar.
Falling, yes, I am falling, and she keeps calling me back again.
The guitarist and vocalist on that homemade recording was a teenager named Mark David Chapman, who a few years later would murder John Lennon. It's one of many spooky moments in this week's Frontline documentary, which is titled The Man Who Shot John Lennon. The program isn't just another chronology leading up to that senseless act of violence. Producer Kevin Sim tries to make sense of the act, at least from Chapman's twisted point of view. It explains how a boy who idolized the Beatles could grow up to hate John Lennon enough to murder him. This is the second time a Frontline documentary has done a psychological profile of a killer. The first one, The Mind of a Murderer, was about mass murderer Ted Bundy and contained videotaped psychiatric interviews with him that gave the documentary its power. The Man Who Shot John Lennon uses psychiatric interviews too. They're on audio tape, not videotape. But the lack of pictures doesn't make what he has to say any less dramatic.
It was like a movie. It was like I was in a movie. I got a gun. I got hollow point bullets. I thought he would just drop right in front of me, and that was it. Well, he was about 25 feet away, but I thought he was just going to fall down, like in the movies, fall down dead. The guy had four holes in him.
Sim talks to people from Chapman's past, his first girlfriend, his friends at summer camp, but gets the most amazing information by analyzing J.D. Salinger's Catcher in the Rye. Chapman identified so strongly with Holden Caulfield, the hero of that book, that he used it as a blueprint for his own life. Like Holden, he loved children and hated phonies. And once he decided that John Lennon was a phony, Chapman went to New York, just as Holden had, and retraced his steps until he got to the end of the book and had no more blueprint to follow.
The story of The Catcher in the Rye ends back in Central Park at the carousel. Here, as Holden watches his little sister go round and round, the tired, confused young hero of the novel finds a kind of grace and relief from the mental turmoil that has haunted him. But for Mark Chapman, watching the carousel that weekend, there would be no grace. For him, there would be one more chapter.
Lennon had just come out with a new album, and the lyrics to one song reinforced Chapman's idea that he and Lennon and Holden Caulfield were all part of the same destiny.
People say I'm crazy doing what I'm doing. Well, they give me all kinds of warnings to save me from ruin. I'm just sitting here watching the wheels go round and round. I really love to watch them roll, no longer riding on the merry-go-round. I just had to let it go. It's incredible.
This documentary is incredible, too, and it has an epilogue that's too powerful and surprising to give away. The Man Who Shot John Lennon will help you understand John Lennon's murder a little more, but it won't make the sense of loss any less great.
David Bianculli is television critic for The New York Post.
People say I'm crazy.
Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Tomorrow, I'll continue my conversation with filmmaker John Waters. We'll find out why his new film, Hairspray, satirizes two dreaded genres, teen flicks and message movies. Also, rock historian Ed Ward will profile rhythm and blues singer Little Willie John. He recorded the song Fever long before Peggy Lee made it a pop classic. And book critic John Leonard will review The Trial of Socrates by journalist and social critic I.F. Stone. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton are the production assistants. Research assistants from Sue Spolin, Ruth Harold, and Gavin Morrison. Our engineer is Ron Barron. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.